Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about Southern culture and the South in general in the colonial period. And the reason I'm doing that, and I'm lumping the founding of Virginia together with the other Southern colonies, is because really what you're seeing here in the colonial period is the creation of a Southern culture. Now, when we move forward in the course, and of course we get into the sectional conflict, there's a general historical interpretation floating around out there that the South really wasn't a cohesive unit, that Confederate nationalism was fabricated out of thin air, and the only thing that held the South together was a resolute defense of slavery. Well, that's simply not true. In fact, if you go back into the colonial period, you'll find that the South definitely had a culture that was different from the North. And I know Dr. Woods is focusing on the Puritans in Massachusetts and Connecticut and elsewhere, and I will talk about the Quakers in another presentation. But we need to address this issue of a Southern culture. And there are actually two distinct types of a Southern culture. One is going to be Cavalier culture. The other is Celtic culture. And in reality, another type, another component of a Southern culture is going to be African heritage. But these two dominant subgroups in the South, the Celts and the Cavaliers, are going to have a drastically different worldview than the dominant cultures in the North, the Puritans and the Quakers. So what you are really seeing in this period of time is that you have these antagonistic sections before we even have the sectional conflict. During the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 and during the Continental Congresses, the colonies recognized that, and then later the states, they all recognized that the North and South was different. These two sections did not get along, and they didn't get along from the colonial period forward. So it's not surprising that in 1861, when things have gotten to a point where there seems like there's no resolution to the conflict, the Union is not going to hold these sections together, that there is talk of secession, and secession actually happens. There was actually talk of secession long before that in both North and South. So the idea that we were one people, and you have this one people ideology floating around out there, or one people, the United States is one people, one nation. Well, that's simply not true. And it's not true going back to the colonial period. So again, what I'm going to do in this presentation, I will talk about Virginia and the Cavaliers, and then I'll talk about the rest of the South and the Celts. So let's start with Virginia. Now, John Smith, Captain John Smith, who is perhaps one of the most important people in American history, and in many ways a real American hero, this is what he said about Virginia in 1624 when he wrote his very famous History of Virginia. He said, "The mildness of the air, the fertility of the soil, and the situation of the rivers are so proprietous to the nature and use of man as no place is more convenient for pleasure, profit, and man's sustenance under the latitude or climate." So Virginia, he thought, was ideally suited for settlement and for growth. And not just that, for profit, for making money, for establishing plantations. And this essentially is the key to the South. There are people out there who are geographic determinists. And of course, you can look at the North and South and realize that, well, these two sections are different because of their climate and geography. And that's going to play a role in how these two areas develop. And it's going to play a role in who's going to want to settle in the South. So what we're going to be looking at in Virginia in particular, at least initially, and then in the other Southern colonies, is a dominant cultural group called the Cavaliers. And I'm going to talk about them in detail. But first, let's look at Virginia. Now, Virginia actually is named after Queen Elizabeth I, often called the Virgin Queen. And it's named this by Walter Raleigh in 1584. In fact, at one time, all of British North America was called Virginia. And so it's not surprising that, again, as you move forward into the colonial period, Virginia claimed a tremendous amount of territory. And, of course, they're going to get this territory during the American War for Independence. But even vast sections of what we call the Midwest today, places like Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, all that was Virginia. Everything, essentially, in the southern part of the British North American colonies was called Virginia. And you might say into the northern part as well. But, of course, that will change once you get into the 1620s. Virginia actually was given the nickname the Old Dominion by Charles II because Virginia resolutely defended the king's interests during the English Civil War of the 1640s. Again, this is a key to understanding Southern culture. The Virginians, the Cavaliers, hated the Puritans, those who were settling in Massachusetts. So you already have two antagonistic cultures establishing themselves here in the colonies. It's no surprise, again, that these two areas are going to butt heads over time. They don't see eye to eye. Now, the first attempt at settling Virginia was actually done in 1584 by Sir Walter Raleigh again. Of course, that colony is going to be a failure. And then in 1587, you're going to have another settlement attempt. This time, it's going to be slightly more successful for a short period of time. And in fact, you're going to have the first English-born child in the British North American colonies during this settlement expedition. Her name is Virginia Dare. And one of the most important people on this second expedition was a guy named John White. Now, the reason John White's important is because he was an artist, and he was able to actually draw what the native peoples looked like in Virginia at the time and give Englishmen a more accurate description of what this particular part of the world was like. Now, of course, this particular colony was actually in what's now North Carolina. But again, this was Virginia. It was, it's often called the Lost Colony. Now, the reason it's called that is because after these people were dropped off in 1587, within a year, we had the English had a major war with the Spanish. And the Spanish, of course, had built a vast navy called the Spanish Armada. Very powerful fleet. And so they're going to attack England in 1588. And the English decide that they need every naval vessel they can muster to help defeat the Spanish Armada. And it's going to work. But they can't get any resupply then back to the colony here in Virginia. And so this colony is going to disappear. Now, there's a couple of different theories as to what happened with these people. One is that they simply moved into the Croatoan tribe, which was on a nearby island. They just left the colony, abandoned it, and moved in with the Croatoans. The other is that the Croatoans actually killed all the settlers and then took the women as slaves. Because for years after this, you have reports of Indian children with blue and green eyes. So obviously there was something to either one. Some of the people that were left or not captured or killed were actually absorbed into the Croatoan tribe. But when they finally get a relief expedition back in 1590, there's no trace of this colony. So from 1590 till 1607, there's not really much interest in the British North American colonies. There is there are people who want to go back to North America, but it's going to take a little time. Again, almost 20 years. Now, in school, you're often taught that the firsts in British North America were established by the Pilgrims. And all of this is wrong. You get a lot of wrong history in school, but I think this is an easy thing to do because, of course, the Pilgrims are fun to talk about around Thanksgiving, little hats and little buckles on their shoes, and you get to dress up and have centerpieces on your table and eat turkey and all these kind of things. But what most Americans don't realize is that the Pilgrims were first at nothing. In fact, Virginia was first at everything when you're talking about the British North American colonies. Virginia was the first named colony in North America by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1584. Virginia had the first permanent English settlement in North America, Jamestown, which was founded in 1607. And so it wasn't Plymouth. Plymouth is founded in 1620, Jamestown in 1607, 13 years before Plymouth. The first Thanksgiving was actually held in Virginia on the 4th of December, 1619, a full 2 years before we had the first Thanksgiving in Plymouth. So when we're even celebrating Thanksgiving, we shouldn't be celebrating the Pilgrims, we should be celebrating the Virginians, because they had the first Thanksgiving, and they did this on a yearly basis. The first assembly in English North America was in Virginia in 1619. So you often hear that the Mayflower Compact and the Pilgrims established the first civil government in the British North American colonies. Well, that's not true. It was in Virginia in 1619. So Virginia is first at everything. And I think one of the reasons why you have the Pilgrims getting credit for so many things is because the North won the war. And when I say the war between the states. Northern history, Northern literature, Northern culture, the Northern view is going to dominate the American experience after 1865. And that doesn't mean it was true, but and I talk about this a lot more when I get into Reconstruction, but it was North over South. And so you're seeing the lingering effects of that in the way that history is taught in your public school systems, even in your private school systems. So, of course, the object of this Liberty Classroom is to get people to understand the real history and what's going on here. And this is part of it. Virginia was first. Virginia was first in everything. And that, and it's so important to understand how Southern culture, because the South really dominated the United States and what it meant to be an American up until 1861, when the South finally leaves the Union, 60 and 61, when the South is out. Most of the presidents in the antebellum period were Southerners. Most of your great American heroes in this period are Southerners. If it wasn't for the South and their insistence on continuing the war during the American War for Independence, the United States doesn't gain its independence. So the South is so important and oftentimes overlooked. And just in other cultural elements, you know, literature and so many things, the South had such a rich history. Now, as I mentioned before, one of the most important people in Virginia was a man named John Smith, Captain John Smith. He was a soldier of fortune, an author, an explorer, and at one time governor of Jamestown. In fact, he came up with a very famous phrase that's in relation to Jamestown: "He who does not work shall not eat." Because when Jamestown is founded in 1607, there's a lot of interesting things going on here. First and foremost, this was a settlement group that had a different perspective on what they were supposed to be doing. In fact, there were people in this initial settlement group who were not really interested in forming a colony, but more importantly, trying to make themselves rich. So when the first three ships, English ships, arrive in Jamestown in 1607, this was in so many ways a disaster. Smith, in fact, was arrested for mutiny on the voyage over, and he was supposed to be perhaps executed when they arrived in North America. But when they open their sealed orders, they find that Captain Smith is one of the directors of the colony, and his job is to secure food and also establish relations with the local Indian tribe. So they can't kill him. So he's going to go out and try to do this. Now, in the meantime, Virginia, of course, is Jamestown is in a very rough spot. It's in the tidewater of Virginia, which is just a very miserable area to be in. Mosquitoes are a problem. Fresh water is a problem. It's just a miserable spot. And so a lot of the people in this initial settlement group are going to die. And the thing is, there's not a whole lot of food around either. So Smith is going to go out and try to establish these relations with the Indian tribes in the area. And, of course, this leads to the very famous story of Pocahontas. According to legend, Smith is captured by these tribes, and most importantly, Chief Powhatan in the area, and he's sentenced to death. It's only through the intervention of Pocahontas that he will be saved. And, of course, then he goes back to Jamestown, and because he theoretically didn't do his job, he's going to be killed then. But a supply ship shows up, and John Smith is able to help save Jamestown, and so Jamestown then will prosper. But it's only through John Smith's insistence that people had to work. This wasn't going to be a free ride. And I think that's something that's often lost. You know, you look at the Plymouth Colony, and it was kind of this socialist utopia for a time, which didn't work. And then you have Jamestown, where you have John Smith saying, look, you're going to work, or you're not going to eat. And so it's an initiative, an enterprise that's going to save Jamestown. And the same thing basically happens with the Pilgrims over time. So it's not this laziness or just this commune idea. You know, people had to work and provide, or they were going to die. Now, another important person in early Virginia history is a guy named John Rolfe. And John Rolfe is the individual who really introduces tobacco to Jamestown and to Virginia in general. John Rolfe, of course, was later married to Pocahontas, and where she became known as Lady Rebecca. But he introduces this production of tobacco to Jamestown. And this becomes the principal cash crop in English North America. So what happens is, as you have this tobacco plant, which the English love, I mean, this is a luxury good. Of course, early on, people didn't smoke it as much, they sniffed it. But you have this tobacco plant, and now you can have plantations in Virginia. You grow tobacco, just like they do in the Caribbean, and you establish large plantations, and you sell this stuff, and you make money. So plantation agriculture would follow tobacco, and so this is an important development in Virginia. Now, as plantation agriculture develops, you're going to have the importance of cavalier culture develop in Virginia as well. And there were four principal reasons that Englishmen migrated to the Americas in the 17th and 18th century. Wealth and land, which is going to be the cavaliers primarily. Religion, which is going to be primarily in the north. Religious persecution, when you look at the Quakers or perhaps the Pilgrims. And maybe even the Puritans. Now, the Puritans are a little different. They're not being persecuted, but they want to actually practice Puritanism in an unfettered form. So they don't think the English church, the Church of England, is Protestant enough. New societies, definitely the Puritans, the Pilgrims, the Quakers, they're going to form these new societies, and that's, again, found in the North. And then there's also these people who come to North America to recreate the English aristocratic lifestyle. So what you have here are two divergent worldviews on why people are coming to the Americas. The northern worldview, which is religion and new societies, and the southern worldview, which was to recreate the aristocratic lifestyle in England and to acquire wealth and land. So again, you're having these two worldviews butt heads early on. The cavaliers who settle in Virginia really don't care about what they do in the north. They really don't care about these new societies and that kind of thing. They just simply want to live like their ancestors did in England before all the land started being gobbled up and there's really none left. So that's why a lot of these guys are coming here. And there's also this idea of these distressed cavaliers, people that were made poor by the English Civil Wars and other things. And so they're going to come over here as well in an attempt to better their life. So let's talk about these cavaliers. A famous historian named Will Durant wrote this about the Cavaliers. Many young nobles facing impoverishment in England migrated to America and founded aristocratic families like the Washingtons, the Randolphs, the Madisons, the Lees. So this is this impoverished or distressed Cavaliers that are coming over in the period after the English Civil War. And then, of course, you have Lewis Wright, who wrote a great book about the Cavaliers in Virginia, the early culture in Virginia. And he said this, "The pattern of life which the ruling class of Virginia planters sought to follow was an ancient heritage dependent upon the possession of land, with sufficient income to maintain one's position with dignity and honor, land and status." Okay, so that's cavalier culture. This is why people were coming to the South, to Virginia and North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia ultimately. They wanted to recreate this English lifestyle, this aristocratic lifestyle that they had in England and somewhere else. And they could get plantations. They could make sufficient income. They had a tremendous amount of land. And so that's the South. Slavery really had nothing to do with it. Slavery followed this, but the culture was there. It was, in fact, this cavalier culture that created the slave climate in Virginia, not the other way around, or the South, not the other way around. Slavery didn't make the South. The South, in so many ways, necessitated this use of slavery for labor because that was an aristocratic lifestyle. Now, who were the Cavaliers? Of course, they're members of the British or English upper class, typically called the gentry. They support the King of England during the English Civil War, and they're typically members of the Orthodox Church of England. Most sought to recreate this English life in America, and they're primarily going to settle in the South, places like Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Maryland, and they're going to dominate Southern culture. And they're also mostly from the southern part of England. And that's important, and I'll talk about that when I get to speech in a second, but they're from the southern part of England. Now, prominent members of the Virginia colonial elite included people like William Barclay, who was the governor of Virginia, William Byrd, who founded Richmond, William Fitzhugh the Elder, Ralph Wormley II, Richard Lee II, the Carters, the Randolphs, the Beverleys, the Tuckers. All these families who are very important in American history are going to be in this cavalier group, in Virginia in particular. These people were well-read. If you look at, for example, William Byrd, this guy had a tremendous library. The idea, and in fact, William Byrd created something called the Royal Society of Virginia. And the idea was to maintain this attachment to the old world and live the life of an English gentleman. Now, there are actually a couple of books that these people read that really codified what you had to do to be a gentleman. The first was called The English Gentleman, and the second was called The Complete Gentleman. And I have these two books listed on your PowerPoint presentation. But people read this stuff, and there were rules that you had to follow to be a gentleman. There were formal rules for young boys, and I'll talk about that when I look at child rearing. But You couldn't just live in Virginia, have a plantation, and be a gentleman. You had to follow the proper rules of conduct to be a gentleman. And that was important. Now, speechways. You get the origins of the Southern accent here. And it's a soft, slow, melodious drawl for your Southern accent. Instead of saying, for example, stay, you said bide. Instead of saying hello, you said howdy. Instead of saying courage, you said grit. Instead of saying beat, you said lick. Moonshine was distilled liquor. Yonder for distant. Right good for very good. So this idea of this hayseed language that people think, oh yeah, the South is just hayseeds, what they're actually doing is hanging on to this very old English language that's very much disappeared in the North in so many ways, but in the South it's still around. In fact, it's said if you want to hear old English, you go into black American communities where they haven't really lost that dialect over time. Shakespeare, for example, was from the southern part of England. And so there's this very popular radio program in the South called Rick and Bubba, and one of the things they do is read Shakespeare with a southern accent, and they're supposedly making fun of it. You know, well, you know, this is hayseed reading Shakespeare. But in fact, that's how Shakespeare would have been read, because the upper class in England wouldn't have had this Elizabethan English. They would have had this southern accent. And so reading Shakespeare with a southern accent is the proper way to do it. Most people don't realize that. They think it's funny, you know, but it's how you're supposed to do it. Shakespeare probably would have had a southern accent. And if you want to hear a southern accent, you go into the southern part of England today in some of these enclaves, and you'll find that. Now, I'm taking this stuff from a very important book entitled Albion Seed by David Hackett Fisher. And I recommend everyone read this thing. It's almost 1,000 pages. But if you really want to get into American culture and where it comes from, you have to read this book. It's a groundbreaking book. And I've given it to you in your reading list. But it's so important that you understand this. And all of this stuff is in there. I'm just giving you kind of a brief overview. Of course, when it comes to culture, marriage, the way people get married often affects culture. And in Virginia, you had a male-dominated family, and you had a sacred union, meaning that the marriage could not be dissolved. So it's going very much back to the Orthodox Christian churches, where marriages, there was no divorce. Of course, in Protestant denominations, most divorce is more accepted, but not in the Orthodox Anglican Church. It's very Catholic in its outlook, which is why the Puritans hated it. You had a Christian ceremony, and then, of course, you had a tremendous amount of feasting. The Cavaliers were famous for that. Cousin marriage was also common in Cavalier society, so families often kept wealth and land in families. And, of course, among the elite families, you're going to have a lot of intermarrying as well. Girls typically marry between 18 and 20, men between 25 and 30. When it came to child rearing, this is an important way to look at a culture. And in Virginia society, they bent the will of the children. They didn't break it; they bent it. And so you had to learn how to learn your proper place in society. For example, children were encouraged to exercise their wills, principally boys. Boys and girls had to learn their proper role in society. So boys actually had it a little tougher. Girls had to learn how to live in society. But boys had to learn how to play two roles. This is a male-dominated society. So not only did you have to learn your formal rules of conduct, like dancing, how to talk to people, how to converse, how to talk to women, you also had to learn how to be a good man, which involved your civic role in society, because the Cavaliers are going to dominate government in civic positions. So you had to learn how to do that. You had to learn how to be a proper warrior. You had to learn how to be a proper hunter, how to provide for your family, how to run a plantation. This is a very difficult life for men. You had to be a real man in this society, and I think that's something that's often lost. It's a very masculine society. You had to be gallant, and that was Southern. So even today, when you have this lingering effect in the South of this very male-dominated culture, a gallant society, you know, gender roles are very defined in the South and in the traditional South. This is where it comes from the Southern culture that has been developed since the 1600s forward. And that came out of Southern England. So people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and, you know, some of the great founders who were from the South, I mean, this is where they're coming from, this type of society. Now, in terms of religion, again, as I mentioned before, these people were Orthodox Anglicans. And, of course, even when you include Catholics, it's an Orthodox church. So they follow traditional rules there. And generally, even in the Anglican church, this is definitely true in the Catholic church, but you're going to have very small parish churches. So religion more was a devotional act rather than a meeting or lecture. As you look at Puritan society, in Quaker society, you go to church to be lectured for a meeting, to formalize how you should live in society, to make sure that everyone conforms. Well, that's not the case in Southern society. You go to church because you're devoted to God. You're devoted to the religion. It is something that's, it's a quiet devotion. And so I think that that's a drastic difference between these two societies in terms of religion. In fact, you had short liturgies and, you know, you didn't have a long, you know, the minister didn't preach to you for an hour. It's a very short liturgy, maybe 15 minutes. Of course, in your Congregationalist churches up north, in particular your Puritan churches, that is the service. The minister going over the Bible is the service, but not so in an Orthodox service. And then, of course, you had your after-service feast, which was very important, which brings me into food. If I was going to eat with any of these cultures, it would definitely be the Cavaliers. They were famous for having meals that lasted all day. And if you want to find the origins of Southern cooking, it's found here in Cavalier society. They ate a lot of beef, fresh vegetables, fresh fruits. They used a lot of seasonings and very delicate flavors. They fried their food quite a bit. They didn't bake much, but they ate a lot of fried food. So, again, this traditional Southern diet that you think about, you know, country cooking, they call it, fried chicken, you know, fried beef, country fried steak, you know, your fresh vegetables, your fresh fruits. I mean, all that comes out of Cavalier society. It wasn't created out of thin air or, you know, like some people think. I mean, this has its history going back to the 1600s. Meals could last all day, as I said, you know, 10-course meals. And that was an event in the South. So you ate. And again, of all the cultures, this is the one I eat with because the other people just don't do like this. I mean, it was often said that Virginians dined, Yankees just ate. And that was true. Now, workways. Ideally, planters did not work hard. But they actually did. I mean, running a plantation is hard work. But what they didn't want to appear to be doing is engaging in commerce. They didn't want to be money grubbers. They didn't want to appear like all they're out for is a merchant, what you have in the North. And there was an interesting quote in the colonial period, and actually leading up to the Constitution, where it was said that money was a good influence in the North, whereas lashings were a good influence in the South. If you wanted to get somebody to do something in the North, you just bought them off because they love money. If you want to get somebody to do something in the South, you got to beat them up. Because they don't really care about it. Now, I mean, Southerners did care about money. In fact, they like to show off their money through ostentatious displays of wealth. But planters didn't want to seem like they were money grubbing, like they wanted to have it in their hands. You know, gentlemen did not engage in manual labor. Gentlemen did not participate in commerce. A gentleman ran a plantation and had time for leisure. That was the idea, to improve yourself, for education, for think hunting, and things of that nature. So this goes back again to this English country lifestyle that all these people are trying to emulate, the aristocratic life of England. It was also important to note that this was a feudatory society, and this goes back into how people were reared in Cavalier society. You had your formal rules of conduct, and then you had to learn how to be a good civic member of society, and you had to participate in that. It was a service, a duty, rather than a station. You had to participate in it. You were elected by your peers, or chosen by your peers. And you typically didn't make any money doing this, and it was a lot of work to be involved in government. It was hard on families. It was required that you had to participate in the militia, for example. I mean, these are things you just had to do. It was your role in society, your duty to do these things. It was not because you sought office or you wanted it, and there were people in the South, of course, who were a little more ambitious than others. But for the most part, I mean, these people were given positions because of their status, and they had to do that. I mean, that's how Jefferson looked at it, for example. The reason why he didn't even mention his time as president or governor of Virginia or any of the other elected positions he had, on his tombstone. He talked about the things that he did, for example, the Declaration of Independence and founding the University of Virginia, and, of course, the Virginia Bill on Religious Liberty. I mean, these are the things he talked about. He didn't talk about being president of the United States because that was his duty. It wasn't like that was a great thing. I mean, he did it because he was elected to serve. And that's important, that judiciary government. Even in the North, even though Northern culture is different, people up North, many of them in the colonial period and then into the early, what's called the early national period, looked at serving in government as a duty rather than a station. So that separates the founding generation from, say, modern politicians who look at it as a great way to make money and empower yourself. That wasn't necessarily the case, particularly in Virginia society. And then, of course, you have wealth. Virginians liked to have money again, but they hated to handle it, and they loved to show it off. In fact, this made a lot of people go broke, because one of the things they're going to want is a tremendous amount of land. And so they're going to acquire more and more land. And land, of course, doesn't produce any income unless you're doing something with it, but you do pay taxes on it oftentimes. And of course, if you do have a plantation in the South, over time, you're going to have slaves. And the slaves are very expensive to maintain. You know, slavery is an expensive institution. A lot of people don't realize that. But to maintain slaves from cradle to grave, when people can and can't work, you have two elements of that. I mean, this gets to be very, very expensive. So living the planter life could be expensive. And a lot of people were in a tremendous amount of debt. I mean, if you look at George Washington, for example, after the War for Independence, the guy was virtually broke. Thomas Jefferson was broke almost his whole life. You know, James Madison had tremendous financial troubles at one point. Some of that was because of his family, but he still had problems with that. I mean, this happened in Cavalier society. People had large homes for the time. They had a lot of land, but they really didn't have a lot of cash on hand. So if you ever want to see what these plantations were like, there's many of them are still left in the South, and a lot of them are open to the public. One of my favorites is the Shirley Plantation in Virginia, which has been continually in the family since the 1600s. The same plantation in the same house since the 1600s. I mean, it's a marvelous testament to the longevity of this Cavalier lifestyle in Virginia. And last but not least, in terms of the Cavaliers, you have power and liberty ways. You know, hegemonic liberty was what they often called it in the South, or what David Hackett Fitcher, I should say, has called it in the South. But generally, these people believed in liberty. Most importantly, though, it was liberty for the dominant group, the Cavaliers. But because of that, because these people had plantations, they were very independent people, they believed in self-government and minimal government. They didn't think that there should be a strong central authority. They didn't think that there was a need for people telling them what to do. They just wanted to be left alone. In fact, when you take people like Nathaniel Macon in North Carolina later on, he considered his plantation his country. So it went from your plantation, then to your county, then to your state, then to the central authority. It was a bottom-up view of government and how important it was. Now Americans seem to flip that on its head and have a top-down view, but the Cavaliers actually had it right. I mean, you take care of hearth and home first, then you worry about your county because that's outside of your plantation or your home, that's the most important thing, or your city, and then you worry about your state because, of course, that can have a role, an impact on your life, and then you worry about the central authority. The central authority was only there for minimal things. Your most important government in your life was your home, and then your county or city, and then your state. And that's the way Cavaliers looked at it. I mean, this comes out of Cavalier culture. The state's rights then wasn't fabricated out of thin air when it was convenient. I mean, Southerners really believed this stuff. And it wasn't just the states. They believed in their plantations, first and foremost, in their counties, and then their states. So, I mean, it was bottom-up view of government, not a top-down. Even though these Cavaliers, of course, are the most prosperous members of their community, it was that view of government that's lingered in the South. You know, the state is more important than the central authority. You had autonomous individuals, meaning these independent individuals. And, of course, that you know, self-reliance, self-sufficiency is very much a part of Southern culture. So this is the basis of Southern culture. And in the next discussion, I'm going to look at, the other Southern colonies and Celtic culture. And I think it's important to talk about the way some of these other Southern colonies were developed, because it'll give you a better understanding, again, of how important Cavalier culture then impacted things like the Carolinas and Georgia and Maryland. And then, of course, I'll also talk about Celtic culture, because on the frontier, things were a little different. There were Cavaliers on the frontier, but the Celts dominated in many ways on the frontier. So in our next discussion, I'll be talking about that.